Hey, it's Shauna Meyerson with Yoga Athletica in Los Angeles, California, here today with my esteemed guest, David L. Bernstein, author of Woke Anti-Semitism. We'll be discussing this book today, as well as theories beyond. And before we start, I do want to say, as a yoga practitioner and somebody who is fully dedicated to the cause of peace, I think that we can all agree that war is terrible. It's horrifying, it's ugly, and it's extremely complex. Too many people have tried to distill the Israel-Hamas war into pithy slogans and overly simplistic equations and equivalencies. Ceasefire equals peace, war equals genocide, and my personal favorite, Israel equals Jews. Such calculations show either a total lack of comprehension or a total lack of critical thinking. Take even 10 minutes to seriously consider any of those theories, and they will simply crumble to dust. Today, we will examine another untenable calculus: racism equals power plus prejudice. And one fact that is irrefutable: anti-Semitism is racism. It's my distinct honor and pleasure today to welcome David L. Bernstein, to distinguish him from all the other David Bernsteins out there, and there are a number, a passionate advocate for the free expression of ideas. David is the author of Woke Anti-Semitism and the founder of the Jewish Institute for Liberal Values, which supports viewpoint diversity, counters radical ideologies in the Jewish community, and opposes novel forms of anti-Semitism emerging from radical social justice ideology. Bernstein previously served as president and CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, executive director of the David Project, as well as various senior roles with the American Jewish Committee. Bernstein has been a leading advocate for Israel's quest for peace and security on the legislative, diplomatic, media, and intergroup relations fronts. David, thank you so much for making the time to speak with me today.
Wonderful to be with you.
Thank you so much. I'd like to begin this conversation by unpacking what could best be described as the woke definition of racism and how it applies to modern day anti-Semitism. So I put together these handy visuals to help the people watching to understand sort of the context of this discussion. We'll start with this basic equation: racism equals power plus prejudice. Now, I know I told you before the show that amazingly on my own, I actually did draw the same conclusions you did, which welcomes you to an elite group of great thinkers. Congratulations. And I just want to say in super layman's terms, putting racism on the left side of the equation and power on the right side makes disempowerment a foregone conclusion. The inclusion of power in this equation means that racism can only be systemic and intentional. David, help me out here.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I first encountered that formula in like 1998. I was on this year-long leadership course in Washington, and we had something called Multicultural Day. And I was super excited for it because I was a young professional who had been doing intergroup relations with other communities like Black Americans and Hispanic Americans and Asian Americans. And so I thought this was going to be a great opportunity to explore our connections. And the facilitator gets up there and he says, racism equals prejudice plus power, or power plus prejudice. I remember thinking to myself, what? I always thought that racism was animus toward another racial group. And after the program was over, I walked up to him and I said, racism equals prejudice plus power. That's not my definition. And he looked at me and he said, that's the definition, whether you like it or not. And I thought to myself, that is in and of itself is a problem. Someone telling me what I have to think. It's not even up for discussion in his view. And that's what I've seen as this sort of ideology about racism and power and prejudice have split, has spread. And yes, it means what you said. You can only be racist if you have power. And you can't be racist. Well, I'll let you go on with your questions. I have a
know
feeling of what they are.
Yes. But I do want to say the irony of the disempowered saying that there's only one way to discuss this and that there is no alternative to it is in and of itself an expression of power by the so-called powerless.
Right, right, exactly.
No irony there. Okay.
No irony.
Let's get on to handy visual number two. So all I'm doing here, guys, is basic math. You learned this in algebra. So if you subtract from one side, you subtract from the other side, and you should wind up with the same equation. Handy visual number two. If you subtract power from both sides, you get racism minus power equals prejudice. Layman's terms, it means that racism must be systemic and cannot be a function of the average person who holds no inherent power. Therefore, moving power to the left of the equation means the powerless cannot be racist. They can only be prejudiced. And I also want to state, everybody knows at this point, this is all being framed in sort of the struggle of the oppressors and the oppressed. Power equals oppressor, disempowered are the oppressed. David, go for it.
Yeah, so I think we have to understand that how this notion of power developed. You know, it started in the academy in like the 1950s in a movement called postmodernism. Now, what is postmodernism? I'm sure you've heard the term, but sometimes it's hard to define. The way we usually think about knowledge and power and everything else is that knowledge is a function of scientific inquiry, of the free expression of ideas, of our ability to argue with each other and try to come to the best conclusion. That's what we think of how our quote unquote liberal system of society works, our operating system in our society. These postmodernists came along and they said, no, 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 that's not how it works. In fact, how it works is that powerful people in society dictate what knowledge is for everyone else. And what they do is they embed their power in the very discourses of society so that they perpetuate their power over time. So what developed out of that was this very simplistic idea that there were certain people who had all the power and everybody else was powerless. And as that ideology evolved, it became very specific to certain groups of people, right? So if you were Black, you were powerless. If you were white, you were powerful. And it's not like that's never true. Of course, like in Jim Crow America, you could argue that was true. And other places that was true at different times. But it's not always true. And what an ideology does is it takes a sometimes and turns it into an always. And so that's why all of a sudden you have a formula. Racism equals prejudice plus power. And I think what you're seeing here is that it's a way of saying, well, if Louis Farrakhan, Minister Louis Farrakhan, who's a known anti-Semite, who called Jews petulant and, you know, and other horrible names, termites, yes, that was the term. He's not really a racist because he doesn't have any power because he's Black. That's, right. Of course, absurd on the face of it. He does have power. Of course he has power. He has a huge platform. He has millions of followers. But we're led to believe somehow that one's race is either a source of power or a source of oppression. And that's the end of the discussion. And I think that's, of course, highly simplistic and ridiculous, but that's where we are and why we end up with these ridiculous formulas that really get us off the mark.
Sure. And I know this is a little bit of a tangent, but it reminds me of something that Shai Davidi told me, which is that at Columbia, anybody who's watching this is perhaps familiar with Shai. If not, you could also check out the episode I did with him. But at Columbia, in all institutions of learning, what happens is they have a system wherein the faculty actually nominates and approves the incoming faculty. And so when it comes to controlling knowledge and controlling education, that this is literally going on in the tenure system, where as one, let's say, pro-Israel professor drops off, there's a quorum of anti-Israel professors that are going to bring in the next anti-Israel professor until the whole narrative shifts. And yes, by controlling the narrative, they are controlling the information as well as how our young people are being taught to think.
Absolutely. Peter Boghossian, the philosopher, calls it idea laundering. And it creates, you create monopolies of groups of people who get to write all the articles in the journals. There's a smaller group of people that chooses what articles in the journal. And before you know it, the ironic thing about this is that they're doing exactly what they claim is being done to by the oppressors to the oppressed. They are actually controlling the narrative, and they are determining what people view as true and what people view as false, by virtue of the power that they've accumulated in the academy. So I think that's quite ironic. And that's exactly what's happened. That's why we have a homogeneous academic system that's producing, you know, same old in scholarship over many, many years. And it's crowded out people with dissenting views. Not altogether, no, not altogether. Of course, there are people who end up in the academy who are challenging it. But it creates a dominant viewpoint within the academy and tries to crowd out everybody else.
Sure. And the vast trickle-down hypocrisy is really quite astounding. And it's one of the things that I really want to discuss today. But first, handy visual number 3. This is the hard one. So if you subtract prejudice from both sides, you get racism minus prejudice equals power. Power now stands alone. This creates a very circular reasoning that brands power as all that is left, and that it's inherently and intrinsically racist, because racism, if you have no prejudice, is what? Pure power.
Yep, I'd agree with that.
The oppressor.
I mean, exactly. Look, that's what you end up with when you look at the whole world from a prism of power. And that's what these folks are doing. And they're trying to force it upon everybody else to see the world in that way. They're trying to force it in institutions. They're trying to force it in the academy. They're forcing it in K-12 education. And they think that it's the only way to look at the world. It's the only lens that we should bring. And they're trying to make sure everybody else adopts it as well.
That's right. I do want to get into ethnic studies, DEI, and some of the other manifestations. But first, let's go back to your actual book. Again, this book, Woke Antisemitism, you wrote in 2022, which is interesting because it's post-George Floyd, but before 10/7. In fact, it's right smack dab in the middle. And it is a surprisingly, at least to me, prophetic bellwether of things to come. Reading it is a little eerie, looking back from 2024. In chapters 5 and 6 of your book, I found that part particularly disturbing, because it was like witnessing a zombie apocalypse. As you were sort of recounting the way your whole world, from like the students — we're talking about people who should have a reverence for hierarchy, or I hate the word hierarchy, sorry — for the people who are teaching them, who are guiding them. So from the students in your David Project all the way back in 2012, through academics, activists, intellectuals, and your own colleagues in Jewish leadership, they all seem to gather from all sides and like paint you into a corner. I'm literally visualizing zombies with paint cans. And in the book, you point out, though, that because of this, you had your own like pattern of fear of publicly speaking out about what you saw unfolding around you. And zombies are scary, but I think they're scarier to like speak up against. And yes, it did make me laugh when you said that your first foray into speaking up against the woke ideology, you did in the exceedingly clever pseudonym David Byrne.
Yeah.
I'm sure nobody figured that out at all. I mean, it sounds like they actually didn't. But let me ask you this, David Byrne, what changed that motivated you to write this book and to just go balls to the walls and speak out so loudly about woke anti-Semitism?
Yeah. You know, there's certain people who can't help but express their authentic view. I'm probably one of those people. I think, you know, there's different strokes for different folks. I'm one of those people who cannot be told what I have to think and what I have to say for that long. Maybe I can put up with it for a week, a month, maybe even a year, but at some point I just can't help myself. And so I was in that situation where a lot of people were imposing their views, but also I couldn't live in myself in another way as well. I felt like I wasn't able to stand up for people who were being bullied. My favorite example of this, and this was really traumatic for me in many ways. There were two Jewish demographers, Ira Sheskin and Arnold Deshevsky, who had written an article saying that there were fewer Jews of color than this new study that had come out implied, based on all the public documents and studies that had been done. And they were absolutely targeted. There was a petition that was signed by 2,500 people, basically calling them racist. And a very prominent leader in the Jewish community accused them of white intellectualism, which was shocking to me because the Jewish community is supposed to prize and admire intellectuals, sure, not demean them. And I was being pressured to sign on to this letter, and I would not sign it. But I also didn't stand up for them at the time, because if I had done that in that job role, I would have compromised my leadership in that role. And I thought, okay, I don't really have that within me. And at some point I realized I can't continue to do this. I'm not going to do a good job at it. I'm not going to do my job well, because I'm operating in an environment that is completely at odds with where I stand and what I think. And I was suffering from what Natan Sharansky, the great Soviet refusenik, calls double thing. Like I thought one thing privately and something else, my public persona, and I could not live with that anymore. And that's why I was very eager, not just to do something different, but to start something new in which I could advocate for the free expression of ideas.
Yeah. And I could feel you writhing as you were writing about like suffering under this double think, because I have to say, I've been a very outspoken advocate for Israel and against anti-Semitism in the far left yoga world. You could imagine the pushback that I've received, but most of the support I get is in the form of DMs. So I understand what you were saying. And I can tell you, as the recipient, it's very frustrating. I would, in the beginning, I used to literally wrote, why don't you write this on my page? And they're like, well, yes, I'm afraid, you know, or whatever. And then I gave up even saying that.
Yeah. I sounded that more times than I can count. Some, you know, look, you appreciate it on one level because you're glad to know you're not alone.
Right.
And you also are like, well, what use is it if the person can't come out publicly? And then I realized something as I was doing the work here. I used to think, am I in the anti-woke business? Am I in the liberalism business? And then I realized, no, I'm in the courage business. And what that meant is that my business was to figure out how to make people courageous and to stand up for their views and to speak authentically. And you do that in a couple of ways. One thing is, the people who are stifling all this discourse are relatively small numbered, but they're loud and well organized. And so they create the illusion of being dominant when they're really not, or really shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. They dominate because of the illusion that they're dominant, not because they've really accumulated in any real power other than just cutting other people down and calling them racist. So what we had to do, our task was then to get critical mass of people who are willing to speak out against them and say, I'm sorry, but I disagree, or I think about this differently, or I will not be intimidated, or whatever, however we want to handle that. And so we have to build critical mass. That's number one. But we also have to teach people to take chances and to sort of get them to understand that they, you know, that they may be catastrophizing about the likely consequences of speaking their minds. I one time was having coffee with a teacher, public school teacher, who was really struggling under the DEI regime of his school system and all the crazy, really extreme forms of DEI that were developing underneath him. And I asked him, well, can you speak about this? And he said, well, I have some concerns. And so I started pulling them out of him. Okay, what are they? What are you really afraid of? And then he said, do you know what I'm really afraid of? I'm afraid of that somebody from Antifa is going to show up my door. Wow. And I said, you know what? I've been doing this. I wrote a book about it. I've been doing this for several years now, and no one from Antifa has ever shown up at my door. Again, and then at that point, he sort of relaxed.
Yeah,
like, I mean, like he had been in yoga class.
It's almost a little egotistical. Like, people say that to me all the time. Don't you fear for your life? I'm like, no, I don't think anybody cares about a yoga instructor in Los Angeles saying she supports Israel. I don't think Hamas is going to come get me. I don't think the anti-Semites who are literally at my temple, or not at my temple, outside my temple protesting, are going to come get me. I'm just a person. So I think that maybe if we can let go of our inflated sense of self, which is largely a product of social media, then maybe we can be braver about using our voices.
Yeah. You know, also, I like to quote the great Natan Sharansky, who I mentioned before. He wrote the foreword to my book. He was the great refusenik. And he points out, look, when I spoke out in the Soviet Union, not only would I be sort of, did I experience censure, but they'll disappear you. They'll put you in the gulag. He spent 9 years in the gulag.
That's right.
He said, no one is going to put you in the gulag for speaking your mind. So, you know, and I remind them of that. I said, if he can risk his whole life and his well-being to speak his mind and to stand up for some principles, can't we put a little bit on the line for our values, our fundamental values, for the free expression of ideas? In Judaism, we call it machloket l'shem shamayim, arguments for the sake of heaven. Shouldn't we be able to stand up for that in our own tradition and against people who are trying to silence us? I think we can. And so that's the courage business. That's getting people to speak out. There's this old phrase, never wrestle with a pig because you'll get dirty and the pig will like it. And I always remind people, look, I said that too. Moderates don't like to wrestle with a pig because we don't want to get dirty. Unless we start wrestling a little bit more, the pig is going to be in charge.
Right.
And so we have to be willing to get a little dirty.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think that what is most upsetting to me, and it comes back to this shutting down of civil discourse, is why do we have to be the ones that cede and say, well, it's okay for them to say these vehemently, violently anti-Semitic, anti-Israel things, but we're afraid to defend ourselves? Like why are we even handing them that permission? Because that's essentially what we've done. Now, if I could just go back 1 second to what you were saying about the vilification of intellectualism, I also, you know, it's funny because I'm very fascinated with the war of words and how people are really changing history by changing the way we use words. I mean, one example is even just enough people have used the word Palestine to refer to something other than British Mandate Palestine, that people who should know better repeat that instead of Palestinian territories, Gaza, Judea, and Samaria. And so this hijacking of vocabulary is very, very significant. And so not only has white become synonymous with evil, not only have Jews become synonymous with a little more than evil, but now we see people looking down on not just intellectualism, but When we think about the word elite, everybody's so derogatory about elites. What does elite actually mean? Elite means the highest echelon of, usually denoting accomplishment. I remember about 20 years ago, it was so long ago, Adam Carolla, who's a comedian who I don't really appreciate at all, but he said something so brilliant. He's like, you know, it used to be that when Mr. Smith drove down the street with his Rolls Royce, a father would say to his son, look what you can have if you work hard in this world and earn it. And now when Mr. Smith goes down the street, the father sneers and says, you see that disgusting Mr. Smith, he's an oppressor. Those weren't his words because they weren't really using the word oppressor back then, but it was the concept. And that really stuck with me. That was, I think, when I started seeing things shifting. In a very dangerous way. But elite does not, by virtue of definition, mean bad. It actually denotes excellence. And we are now in the business of dumbing down our nation, of the process of equity. And I loved the cartoon that you explained in your book about that equality was that we have three kids trying to watch a baseball game over a fence and they all have equal boxes, but the short kid still can't see. Equity, the short kid gets a higher box, but then there was a third version where the tall kid had his was cut off at the knees. And
exactly.
We are definitely living in these cutting off at the knees, race to the bottom, instead of the search of excellence, which I think is more damaging than its implications for anti-Semitism and really for all of Western civilization.
Right. Yeah. And you're really seeing this play out in K-12 education more than any other place. And that's one thing my organization, the Jewish Institute for Liberal Values, really focuses on. So if you look at several schools, many school systems around the United States, they used to be focused on trying to improve test scores among everybody, all students, right? And they moved to a new paradigm that is student achievement gap oriented, because it's based on this idea that if there's a gap in achievement between different groups, it means that there's systemic racism at play. There can be no other explanation for why there might be achievement gaps. So you move away from everybody's test score. So now a school will be rewarded, or a teacher will be rewarded, or a principal will be rewarded based on narrowing achievement gap. But what does that do? If you can't bring the bottom up, you bring the top down, right? And that's what we're seeing in a lot of places. Well, then we got to get rid of the AP program, because we've got to narrow the student achievement gap. We got to get rid of the magnet school. We got to narrow the student achievement gap. What they're not doing is trying to lift up the bottom, because they don't know how. And they're on a sort of wild goose chase to find the culprit. Who's responsible for this achievement gap? And I think it's completely ass backwards. I don't think it is helping anyone, particularly the people who it's pretending to help.
Yeah,
I mean, I always tell people, because all this gets sort of, it gets a patina of race involved, and everybody gets, you know, I said, let's take race out of it for a second. Let's say you were, you took a kid from coal mining town in West Virginia who grew up very poor, didn't have a very strong educational background. His parents weren't educated, and the parents moved to a upwardly mobile public school district, right? Because they wanted their kid to have something more than they had in an education. And they took on menial jobs and everything else just to make sure the kid could get an education.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid is far behind. Now, do you want, if you're that parent or you're that child, do you want the school system to try to narrow the gap between your child and everybody else? Or do you want some supports that will help that child achieve over the long run so that they can catch up? You want them to catch up. The system we have in place now is trying to just bring everybody down.
Yeah.
And it is a race to the bottom, and it is a way of chopping off the kids' legs at the knees so that nobody can see the baseball game.
Yeah, I'll tell you to one is a little funny, one's not as funny at all, instances of the same. So my older sister and I started Jewish day school when she was in third or fourth grade, I think. So she was put in the Mechina class. Now we joke that it's Mehina because they couldn't say the H sound because they didn't know Hebrew yet. You have to be Jewish to appreciate that joke. But the point was that if a kid came into a school that half the day was in Hebrew, they were put in a special class, exactly what you're saying, to bring them up to speed so that they could be mainstreamed into the other class that already knew their Hebrew. Now, somewhat ironically, many years later, my niece, her daughter, who got stuck in this equity system of education sort of midstream, she's a senior at UCLA now, she was like 2 or 3 years ahead in math when they decided that all kids needed to be equal in math. And they created special classes to hold back the students who were learning above their level. And so that she could only be, you know, in calculus when everyone else was in calculus, which, you know, I think we're about the same age. I'm 53. I know you're a couple years older. But back then, first of all, skipping grades was a very normal thing. But second of all, I mean, it was a point of pride, those of us who were a year or two ahead in math, and you knew who the kids were who were ahead in math. Nobody tried to hold you back. In fact, when I was a senior, they actually sent a bunch of us brought the college to us, actually, because they did not have a calculus program at the high school. And they wanted those of us who sort of aged out of the math system to still have math. And so they brought in professors to teach those of us calculus. Like, that was the way it used to be. Now, how are we supposed to succeed as now we're really off track. Sorry.
Yeah. Imagine America in 25 years if we're stifling our best math students in the name of equity. I mean, it will not help us be a competitive country, and it will make it, and we will lose ground. And I can promise you this, the Chinese are not stifling their best math students in the name of equity.
That's right. And at the same time, they're purchasing all our debt. But okay, that now we're really, let's get back to woke anti-Semitism, shall we? So I do want to talk about your choice of titles. I think it's funny because, not funny, like haha, but how timid you were about getting into this vocal space. And then you're like, I'm not just going to call this anti-Semitism. I'm just going to go full throttle. I'm going to call it woke anti-Semitism. So let me ask you first, because I have had a lot of pushback on using the word woke this year, which was very weird because I never heard it again. And again, this is a rewriting of the narrative. But has the word woke been hijacked by its detractors?
Look, I think it's obviously considered a provocative term. Even when I was using it, it's considered more provocative now than it was then. It was considered provocative. I remember I was talking to a friend of mine who had just read John McWhorter's excellent book, Woke Racism. And I was telling him about the book I was writing. He said, you have to call it woke anti-Semitism. And I said, so you're going to get me in trouble here, aren't you? Like, I remember I was thinking about it then. But once, you know, but I knew it was going to get eyeballs, right? I knew people were going to then read it. And it would be an opportunity for me to say, well, I know you think this is provocative, but it's actually quite moderate.
It really is.
Right. And what, you know, increasingly, I don't use the word that much. Like, when describing the ideology, you know, a lot of people are calling it the pressed oppressor ideology or pressed oppressor binary. I just need a word that describes this dynamic that we've been talking about and what I mean by that. And if people can get away with using a different word, let's use that word. I'm not going to rename my book. And I'm not going to certainly castigate anybody who uses the word woke. And I'll work it in every once in a while. A lot of times people will say woke, quote unquote, as if that somehow gets you out of using the word.
Right.
But you know, I do think we should we shouldn't get, I mean, the fact that people are getting so caught up in this word tells you a lot about the problem itself.
It
doesn't
sure
it?
Does.
Like, if everybody's so obsessed about some word that
right.
is somehow being misused or misappropriated, doesn't
right.
that tell you, isn't that tell you like there's a hypersensitivity in the air? I'm telling you that I don't mean anything derogatory
right.
about the word. I'm telling you, I mean something very specific. But they won't, a lot of people will say, no, I'm not even talking to you because you're using this word that I've attached certain
right.
meaning to, even if you don't attach that same meaning to it.
Yep. This comes back to that weaponization of words again. I've also mentioned a lot of times, like when people equate, I mentioned this in my talk with Rabbi Wolpe, who amazingly and beautifully wrote what's it called for your book?
A blurb, yeah.
A blurb. But that the conflation of anti-Semitism with Islamophobia is false because phobia means fear, not hate of. And they are completely different concepts. One is the fear of radical Islam and one is the hatred of Jews. So that being said, okay, so words matter. They really do. How would you say that woke anti-Semitism is different from just like historic anti-Semitism, basic run-of-the-mill, vanilla Jew hatred?
Yeah. Well, obviously it is of a piece of anti-Semitism historically, but I think it's a distinct variant in many ways because it relies on a discourse that's very different than what we've had in the past. You know, we all recognize right-wing anti-Semitism as the sort of old version. It seems to be very brazen, by the way. You know, the Jews control the media, Jews control the banks and what have you. A lot of times it involves blood libel, you know, and you know, if you really hear the more extreme forms of, you know, Jews are trying to poison people, Jews are trying to kill others. They're using the blood of Christians in their matzahs. That was the old
right.
formulation. And then you have Muslim anti-Semitism, which is also quite brazen. And it, you know, and it also is highly conspiratorial and hides nothing. We've had left-wing anti-Semitism for a long time that originated in the Soviet Union that was really aimed at Zionism. The Soviets were trying to discredit Zionism in the late 1960s after Israel's victory in the Six-Day War, and they created a whole field called Zionology, and they wrote books about it and articles about it and the like. And it took a few years, but in 1975, the UN passed the Zionism as Racism Resolution. And so it was catching on, and it was finding its way into the discourse. And so we could always say, well, the left-wing anti-Semite tries to hide behind Zionism. But this is even a different variant of that because it is based on this oppressed oppressor ideology that really made its way into our institutions. And it's this idea that white people are powerful and non-white people are powerless. And therefore, by virtue of our average household income as Jews or our average educational achievement as Jews, we are by definition a powerful group. And the only way one can get power is to do it on the backs of others. It's to be in cahoots with white supremacy.
That's
and
right.
So therefore, Jews, a group that are succeeding, must have gotten their power by defining themselves as white and therefore taking advantage of their perceived whiteness and dominating other people in the process.
Yeah.
And that's really what you see. And you see, really, I have to tell you, when I wrote the book in 2022, I sort of edged a little bit. There's a whole chapter, I think it's right, where I say, look, some of the things that I'm warning here haven't come to pass yet, but I'm worried they're going to come to pass. And I have to tell you, I thought maybe 5 years, 10 years. After October 7th, boy, oh boy, did we start to see it. You know,
right.
At Columbia University, the administration held a meeting with the Hillel director at Columbia, the Jewish Student Life director at Columbia, Brian Cohen. And he was talking about how Jews are experiencing the current moment at Columbia. This is just last spring. And there were three deans,
right,
who were texting each other saying, that were texting each other saying, these Jewish students are all privileged. Now, that's really brazen. And what I think we've seen in the last few months, in the last year, is that left-wing anti-Semitism has become every bit as blatant, brazen and ugly as right-wing anti-Semitism, and just as violent. You know, another thing I used to say before October 7th, I used to use this formula that the head of the ADL, Jonathan Greenblatt, would say, which is that anti-Semitism on the right is like a hurricane. It's hard hitting. It is violent. But anti-Semitism on the left is like climate change. It is slowly corrosive and the like. And I believe that. But now when you look at anti-Semitism on the left, it's not like climate change. It's like a tsunami.
That's right.
And so we're seeing anti-Semitism on the left and what I would have called woke anti-Semitism really become a very aggressive force. One last point on this. What we've also seen in the last 10 years, but especially since October 7th, is what some call the emergence of the red-green alliance in the United States. And that's the alliance between radical Islam and progressive ideology. And what we're seeing on campuses very often are radical Muslim groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, who are leading the protest and are defining the talking points and the messaging for the larger progressive movement. Right. And that, I think, is a very disturbing development, something we have to push back against hard.
I have one word to respond to that, and then I want to go on. Greta. Okay, let's go on. So let me just say that, again, I just want to reiterate and expound on what you said. That the anti-Semites on the right, which I would say is sort of like the traditional anti-Semitism, they admit they're anti-Semitic, and they even to a large extent like define themselves by their hatred. They love being Nazis or Proud Boys or whatever they are. Like they have no qualms about like wearing that literally on their sleeve, often in the form of a tattoo. Anti-Semites on the left, however, not only do they deny that they have the problem at all, but they try to disguise it as social justice, which is why I think so many people have put so much faith in the left, and why I can only say progressive in quotes anymore, because I think it's become extraordinarily regressive. But why so-called progressive ideals have taken over our country. Hate is being passed off literally as social justice. Like calling for global intifada is not a call for peace. Calling for destruction of the state of Israel is not a call for tolerance, and calling for support of terrorism is not a call for social justice, no matter what they say. And even as they deny their own anti-Semitism, and they really, really do not want to be associated with the term, I have people in my own family who are super liberal, who are like, what are you talking about, anti-Semitism from the left? I'm like, what? But ironically, even as they're running away from it, like they're really simultaneously promulgating all of the beliefs, all of the tropes with absolutely no shame and no restraint.
Right. You said no shame, and I want to pick up on that for a second.
Yeah.
There's a school district in California called Las Lomitas. I think right. I have it right.
Yeah.
And they recently brought in an outside group called Parseo that is affiliated with Liberated Ethnic Studies that holds that Israel is a settler colonial state that is explicitly anti-Zionist, that is right. conducting anti-Semitism training, or was scheduled to conduct anti-Semitism training for the school district. Right. Now that's unbelievable, like that a school district would hire a group like that, that denies anti-Semitism on the left altogether, that you could argue, and I would argue, is practicing anti-Semitism to actually train teachers about anti-Semitism.
Sure.
And that's something you wouldn't see on the right. And in many ways, look, I'm someone of the left. I've been in the center left my entire life, but I am more afraid of the left today than I am the right.
So I'm
afraid of the right. And there's aspects of the right that I think are very dangerous. But today I think the left is just every bit as dangerous as the right, and even more so because of its ability to insinuate itself in institutions and to do exactly what that group Parseo did in getting into the school system. It pretends to be on the side of the angels. It depends to be creating the community of the good. And it is creating the most divisive, most polarizing, most ugly society that you can possibly imagine. And I think that's why they're so dangerous, because they try to do it in the shadows rather than do it in the open. I'd much rather have people do it in the open.
Sure. Look at Harris's appointments for dealing with Jewish and anti-Semitism relations. Hard stop. I don't want to get really into politics right now, but even Dershowitz, you know, a lifelong Democrat, is becoming in the last few weeks, like, announced that he is now an independent. And I became an independent. I can't remember if it was. It was at least the first Obama term when I saw how anti-Israel he really was, if not before that. But I think that voting down ticket these days is a very naive endeavor.
I'm going to even stay away more from politics than you did. But I'm resisting in a way, like turning it into a partisan issue, because I want people who might still, whatever reason, vote for, you know, either party, to be able to say, like, I want them to take the ideas seriously. And sure. I want them to think independently about this. One of the things that I've argued in this chapter of a book recently, it's the book is Jewish Priorities. And I have an article about anti-Semitism on the left and the right. And I said, look, I think the Jews have to understand that they're really not safe in either political movement, on the right for a lot of reasons, or on the left for a lot of the reasons that we've been talking about. We have to understand, like, maybe it's time for us to sort of build our own friends, build our own coalition, not look for a safe harbor in a place we're not going to get safety.
Coalition building is a little difficult right now. If it was scary and hard for you to speak up for yourself, I mean, how much harder is it for a group that isn't Jewish to speak up in public for us? And again, the DMs are great, but we see, like, this mass silencing of what we know to be the moral majority. Every single poll that comes out says that approximately 80% of Americans land squarely in the pro-Israel camp. And yet all we hear is the anti-Israel camp. So there's this shaming and silencing of would-be allies. So it makes the allyship effort, though I love it in theory, a lot less tenable.
Yeah, but I'm not asking them to be my ally on anti-Semitism. It would be nice, but I'm not asking them. I'm asking them to be voices for themselves in their own interest. In other words, I want to work with Indian Americans or Chinese Americans or Black Americans because we're aligned, not because they necessarily feel the same thing I do about anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. That's the nature of the coalition. The coalition is to stand up for American values, Western values, whatever we decide to call them. That's the coalition. And they may come at it from a different place. If I work with Chinese Americans, they may not be worried about the anti-Semitism that my kids are facing in the classroom, but they may be worried about shutting down the magnet school that their kids go to, the same ideology, and they're feeling it too. And the Hindu Americans may be worried about, you know, the introduction of caste, which is into the curriculum. They're experiencing what we're experiencing from their own communal standpoint. That's where the coalition can be. And it can be with people with veterans, and it can be with others who care about the nature of the discourse in the society. So I think I'm asking us to reframe this, not as a coalition around anti-Semitism, but a coalition for these fundamental core values in our society.
Sure. So let me ask you then, how would you separate this concept of coalition from intersectionality? Because it sounds a whole hell of a lot like a page out of the SJP playbook.
Yeah, so the intersectional idea, it's funny that you say that, and it's a bit ironic as well. Look, in a way, I'm going to give you an answer that a friend of mine and colleague of mine that I work very closely with, she's a marketer who's done a lot of market research on perceptions of Jews in Israel, how she answers this. She said, like, she was tracking for many years perceptions of Jews, even, particularly among young people. And and the data constantly showed that there was this very wide swath of people who just didn't care one way or the other. They were just, Israel and the Middle East were not their primary concern. Just as maybe Ireland, she would say, was not my primary concern. I knew there was a conflict, but I didn't really have much of an opinion on it, right? Who was right, who was wrong. She said that we could start to see a change in the mid-2015, 16s, and then now, and the data is showing this, that's narrowed. And what happened was that the anti-Israel voices and the ideologues and the Islamist radicals were able to become relevant to young people through intersectionality. They were able to say, our cause, we are the powerless. We are the paradigmatic powerless. And so you should include us and allow us to be front and center of your intersectional movement around power. And so you start to see them become, in the parlance of a marketer, relevant. Anti-Semitism, that what we're fighting against, is not relevant to the vast majority of Americans. I mean, they might care about it to a certain degree, but they're concerned about other things. They might be concerned, they're concerned about America.
Right.
And if we want to become relevant to our own intersectional framework, I mean, I think it's not exactly the right term for it, but to build our own coalition, our own set of allies, we have to be relevant to them. And we're not going to be relevant to them because of our concerns. We're going to be relevant to them because we share concerns. So if a group of moms, for example, who are not Jewish, say, my kids go to a college and be walking around dodging encampments all day long, we're relevant to those moms, not because of anti-Semitism, because they don't want their kids walking around encampments all day long either. That's not the environment they went to for their kids. Or if we work with parents, with veterans, because those veterans don't want to see flags being torn down on campus, or the U.S. flag being burned or whatever, we now have new allies around that we didn't have before because it's relevant to them, not because Israel and Zionism are relevant to them.
Okay, so let me ask you a question then. I could argue based upon that the vast outcry after the George Floyd incident would not be relevant to most people other than the fact that systemic hatred is relevant. And systemic oppression, whatever it is, however you look at it, police brutality, hatred of African Americans or other racial minorities is not relevant to the majority. That's why those are minorities. So isn't hate in and of itself, as it destroys societies, relevant just by virtue of existence? A society that is consumed by hate is a society that is destined to consume itself.
And I think that's true. And I think you could try to broaden it, but then of course you risk just dumbing down anti-Semitism and just another form of hate. I don't think that's what's really going to get the coalition going. The coalition is going to go because people have interests and or they have preferences in society. And if we can tap into those and make it not about us, but make it about a larger set of interests and values that people share, that's what we're really fighting against. To me, the growth in anti-Semitism is a function of the deterioration of sort of the American idea and of the core values that we share. Not that anti-Semitism doesn't exist on its own. It existed before this deterioration was taking place, but it is fueled by this sort of tearing apart of the basic and fundamental agreement on values that we once had. And so as that changes, as people start in a way tearing down the American idea, we have an opportunity for an alternative coalition that I think is much more powerful than just opposition to hate. Because also, if the existing coalition around hate has actually embraced this ideology, so it's come prejudice plus power, unfortunately. And so we'd have to create another one. And I think a more powerful idea is, what are we for? We're for the preservation of key ideas like the free expression of ideas, freedom, equality, opportunity. Those are what our society was built on. Those are, I think, ideas we need to reclaim.
Yeah, the problem is that those who are in these intersectional coalitions are using the free speech that you talk about as their own straw man so that they can speak, but no one can speak against them. So this all becomes like a very like self-nurturing cycle of everything is about protecting me and nothing is about protecting you. This is a real problem. If we say that we're protecting me because I want to protect everyone, but actually all I really want to protect is me and vilify you, I don't see where the opening is right now at this point in time for inserting general tolerance into the equation.
It's not general tolerance. It's a set of values that most people already believe, and that believe that those values are being torn down. People believe in the American idea. They're, and they want to live in a society that believes in the American idea. And if they feel that the American idea is on the ropes, then they're going to stand, then they may be willing to stand up for it. And I think our job is to catalyze that movement. The vast majority of Americans live between the 30-yard line and the 30-yard line politically. They're not extremists on either side.
Sure.
But the people who live on the 30-yard line to the 30-yard line tend to be more moderate. They tend to be the people who don't want to get dirty. They tend to be people who just want to live their lives, take their kids to soccer or hockey or baseball, or whatever they want. And now they're saying, well, what's happening in my own country? Why are we so polarized? And I think we've got to organize that coalition. And it's in a society where that coalition is stronger, where people start standing up for those core values that we once took for granted, that we're going to see less and less anti-Semitism, in my view. So it's not so much about, it's not about tolerance, it's not about anti-hate, it's about values that are considered core to America, I think. And I think we have to understand that was once much more commonplace. My wife, who happens to be pretty close to me right over here, but you don't see her, when Betty White died, the actress, nearly 100, she started watching these old episodes of The Golden Girls.
Right.
And so I would listen to her while she was watching on her phone. And this one conversation that was happening, like, totally blew me away. The Bea Arthur character, Dorothy, was talking to her mom, Sophia, and I don't remember Sophia, the actress's name. And she says, "Mom, you were the one who put the American flag in my hand. You were the one who taught me what it meant to be America and what it was first like to see this country at Ellis Island." And he went on and on about that. And I thought to myself, how quaint. That is how liberals used to talk.
That's this right.
Yeah, it's show at the time. This was a progressive show.
Right.
And that's how liberals used to talk. It's in our collective consciousness. We've got to reclaim that discourse.
Sure. The actress was Estelle Getty.
Thank you.
Just in case we play Trivial Pursuit, you get that, the pink one, I think.
I'll never win.
Neither do I. I probably could come up with like three answers, but right now that's one of them. Okay. So I agree, and most studies will show that there's 10% that are radically on this side, 10% that are radically on this side, 80%, which is a little more than the 30-yard lines, who maybe are just sort of the soccer moms. Okay, we'll call them the soccer moms, hockey moms, and baseball dads, whatever you want to call them. I'm going to go ahead and argue that that is the default for humanity, and most likely even most of the Europeans Europeans, because everyone who thinks that this was a German problem is greatly mistaken, that most of the Europeans in the Nazi era were probably mostly soccer moms as well. And though I honestly do believe, from all my Holocaust education from a very early age, that the European populace was actually complicit in the atrocities of the Holocaust, I can also argue that they had plausible deniability, which is most of them do. But a fish only understands water after it experiences air. And today's anti-Semites are espousing their views with the full awareness of what transpired during the Holocaust, during World War II, which means that either they're incapable of seeing the parallels or they're completely comfortable with them, which is very dangerous. Which one do you think it is?
Let me first say that I'm not making a universal claim about all societies at all times.
Yeah.
Like, I think even in the Arab world, it would be overstating it to say that the vast majority supports, let's say, ISIS or Hamas. Okay. But a lot of people do. And it's a much higher percentage that support extremist ideas than Americans do. I think Western societies that have gone through a very long period of living in democracy and have a certain set of values are much more moderate, and by and large, than a lot of other places in the world. So I'm not making a universal claim. I'm just saying in America, most people have moderate views, and you can test that out. It's available in all the survey data. Wait, according to the Harvard-Harris poll, 80% of Americans continue to support Israel.
Exactly.
So you wouldn't know that by looking at the, you know, at the streets of wherever, LA or New York or, but that happens to be the case. So it's a relatively small percentage of people in specific institutions. Unfortunately, by the way, a disproportionate number of young people. So we have to worry that as we age out, that will change. In other words, it won't be 80, it will be 70, then it'll be 60, then it'll be 50, then it'll be 40.
And by the way, that's not just general populace. We're also talking about our next generation of leaders. I mean, this is everybody, and particularly the leaders, because it's particularly coming from the elite institutions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why I think we have a real problem. We have to fight it. But, you know, I have kids who range from 19 to 27, and all their friends and anybody that they bring home or whatever, I'm the annoying parent who asks, like, hey, what do you think about the world? And what do you think about this? And because I always want to get some data out of every conversation. Right. And I find that actually they tend to be very lefty, but they're not as ideological as they're portrayed. And you know, there are some, and we know that, you know, they may be at your dinner table, I don't know, or at your Passover Seder or whatever, but most aren't that way. So I think we've got to start giving them the language of the alternative language, the alternative framework, that it's no, you've been fed a line by your university, by your high school teacher, whoever else, that the world is only made up of oppressed oppressors, and then challenge that paradigm and start introducing other ideas into the bloodstream of society. And I think we can turn it around, but it's not going to happen overnight. And yeah, there's probably going to be some slippage in the meantime.
Is that, I mean, I see that as somewhat of a jagged pill to swallow. So Rabbi Wolpe, again, he actually happens to be my rabbi. I'm very fortunate. But one of the things that he has pointed out, having nothing to do with this really, is that the Jewish concept, which we see over and over in the liturgy of L'dor V'dor, which you also allude to in your book, from generation to generation, that paradigm, which used to be one in which the older generations were able to impart wisdom and knowledge to the younger generations, has been flipped on its head because we have 2-year-olds who can use an iPad better than a 90-year-old. And we have 12-year-olds who are consulting with their 40-year-old parents on how to use a new app. And so now, the kids today, to a large part, are not looking to the adults in the room for guidance, unfortunately. Yes. They are looking to TikTok. And so when you say that we need to give them the talking points, the we winds up being China or Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk. I don't think most kids are on X, but as they go older and maybe a little bit more sophisticated, that maybe they move to X. But this narrative is being controlled, moderated, and forced onto these children. So even if we give them the talking points, because I've got 5 nieces and nephews who are all in college, and my parents and I work very hard to try to give them the talking points. At the same time, I'm not sure how effectively they land. They're creating their own opinion. And by the way, all 5 of them are very pro-Israel and very fighting well for anti-Semitism, I have to say. But it's because of their own independent research and conclusions that they've drawn rather than anything that's being forced upon them. And that's how they see it now, that anything that comes from older generations is more being forced upon them than bestowed upon them.
Yes, look, I think that's right. I think we've allowed a certain inversion where now the young are expected to teach the old. And it's very strange in Jewish life where we've always believed that, you know, older people have wisdom that they can impart to younger people. And now we're listening eagerly to everything our kids tell us about social justice so that we can then design a Jewish community that's meant to attract them. And I think that's that's twisted thinking. And I think we've got to go back to an older model. Sure, listen to them, understand what they think, but don't be so obsessed with their views that you're going to bend over backwards to create a new Jewish community that's meant to bring them in. And I think that's sort of a microcosm of the larger problem. Yes, you're right. It's coming from other places that we don't have easy control over. I think we can start contesting more there. And maybe TikTok doesn't belong in the United States. I'm a big free speecher, but that doesn't mean I want a Chinese controlled company that's, you know, installing software in our kids' brains. And so I think that I think we should find, and there are people working on this. And again, what do I want to happen? In fighting anti-Semitism and anti-Israelism? I want these social media, I want to get more content about values out that we agree on. I want to get the alternative framework out. Because if people are conditioned to think in terms of oppressed and oppressors, they're going to see Jews as oppressors. And so we've got to install a different worldview in the minds, that one that's open, ones that teaches people how to think critically and doesn't accept these pieties as if they're given, as if they come down from Mount Sinai. You don't mind me using all this Jewish language.
Right. I sort of feel, unfortunately, though, that we find ourselves in a conundrum where the advocates of free speech have led us to this place of indoctrination inadvertently, particularly in the information age. If we give everybody a voice and the loudest voices are the angriest voices, then we find ourselves caged in this narrative that we're not only in many instances forced to believe, but being forced to actually say, as we saw, particularly during BLM, when they wanted everyone to literally say the words, you know, Black Lives Matter. The worst thing you could say in the whole world was All Lives Matters, even though in this day and age, even though anti-Semitism accounts for more than 50% of all hate crime in America, that means that if you take hate crime against every single religion and put it together, it doesn't amount to the amount of hate crime against the 2% of America that happens to be Jewish, right? And so,
I want to push back on one thing that you said a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't believe the problem is free speech that created this. I believe the problem was actually the stifling of free speech that created this. Look, if you look at the recent rankings of FIRE, the organization that pushes back against radical ideology and for free speech on campus, which campuses are the bottom three? Columbia, Harvard, and Penn. Bottom three. Those happen to be the places where there's the most anti-Semitism as well. In other words, if there's a prevalent ideology on campus that makes it so that Ben Shapiro or whoever else can't speak on campus,
right,
that's exactly the place you're going to experience anti-Semitism.
Exactly. But what I'm saying is it's because of this free speech ideology of allowing people to speak in defense of terror, for example, wherein that used to be, you know, something that never would have been allowed on campus, by letting those people on and then shouting down the other people, which people are also saying that shouting down is free speech, which is
right. No, that's not. That's conduct. And I think we can make it. Look, if you ask me, what would I rather a university do? Would I rather the university say, look, we're going to be a free speech campus. That doesn't mean you can have an encampment. You can't have a permanent, you know, exhibit on campus. You can, but you can, you can march, you can chant. And you can't shout anybody down. You can't stifle anybody else's free speech. You have your right to free speech, and we'll even let you say things like, you know, from the river to the sea or whatever. We're not going to stop you. Versus a campus that says, we're not going to allow anything that we deem racism or anti-Semitism or everything else. We're going to shut this down. And now everybody has to comply to our speech codes. I will take the former over the latter every time. Every
as
single
long
time.
As both sides get the chance.
Yes. But the problem is,
that's
not what's happening. So we have a choice. Either we can level up or we can level down.
Right.
And I want us to level up, right? I want us to push for saying, look, you're hypocrites, Harvard, you're hypocrites, Penn, you're hypocrites, Columbia, and we're going to hold you accountable for your hypocrisy. So, but I want them to say, now we're going to have free speech for everybody and not just for radicals that you happen to agree with. If you're really believing free speech, then it has to be for everybody. That means you tear down the DEI department that's shutting down everybody's speech. That means that you allow people to challenge the unchallengeable. And if you don't do that, then you're just hypocrites. But I would rather push in that direction than push for a race to the bottom, because I don't think we're going to end up doing very well under the anti-speech regime.
Okay, so then I guess I'll ask, like, where is the line then between free speech and hate speech? And also, I do want to say that when it comes to, again, like giving everyone the chance to speak, we have imams, for example, who are calling for death to all Jews, but you will never, as in ever, find a rabbi who calls for death to anyone, Muslim or otherwise. And so to say that there is no line is to say that, okay, well, you could call for our death, but we get to say, here's an IDF person explaining why we're in Gaza. It sounds like, and I agree to an extent, that perhaps the argument is we just need to grow thicker skins. We've been coddled. We don't like adversity. Just learn to live with it. But at the same time, there's a big difference between calling for peace and calling for the genocide of an entire people.
Yeah, I think it was Louis Brandeis who said sunlight is the best disinfectant. And I generally believe that. Look, I'm not saying these are easy issues. And I understand that if you have an imam who's calling for the murder of Jews, we're not going to exactly extend them a platform. And we shouldn't extend them a platform. But, you know, I don't want that to be illegal either, because, you know, you have to, either the speech is protected or it's not. Even when I was 14 years old and I watched the movie Stokey, I knew that I didn't like Nazis, but I also didn't believe that we should stop them from marching. And that's a horrible feeling, I'm sure. I wasn't there at that time, but to have Nazis march in a place where there's a lot of Holocaust survivors, there can't be anything worse than that. Yet I understand that the principle of free speech probably requires that. I think that's what we should. It's the best we can do. The societies that have less free speech than we have in Europe, they're not places where we want to live. So even though we don't like that really negative speech, I can tell you that the more society curbs speech, the more problems we all have. Because what do they do when they curb speech? They're not using the standard that you just laid out about peace and hate. They're empowering a 24-year-old Oxford or Harvard graduate to decide for you what's acceptable speech and what's not acceptable speech. You're not going to end up with your version or my version of what acceptable speech is.
Do you think the government has a role in like making that delineation? I mean, I agree that everything becomes a slippery slope, but if there were actually, legislation that said this qualifies as free speech, this qualifies as hate speech, and never the two shall meet. No, okay.
I would be very against that, because in the real world that we live in, the people who will make those decisions will be people that you don't like or I don't like. Maybe for a while we'll like them. You'll like them when your favorite political leaders are in power and they empower people that you agree with in that bureaucracy. But the bureaucracy of free speech versus hate speech will become a bureaucracy that eventually you don't like and is stifling your speech. And so when all is said and done, I think it's the best we can do. And I want to protect the free expression of ideas. I want people to be able to argue with each other and have differences of opinion. And there are things, of course, I'm not going to argue about, but that doesn't mean I want the government to regulate those things either. Because I think that we can see what the alternative brings us.
Yeah.
And America, for all its faults, is still a better place to be Jewish than it is in any other European country, for sure, any other Western country. So I don't want their model. I don't want to trade in our model for their model. America would be more America.
Sure.
And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. This is still the best place to be a Jew other than Israel. Right. But that lends itself to some thorny conclusions. I don't want to take too much of your time, but let me ask one more thing. And this might go into taking up a lot of your time, but let me just ask, because you are such a prophet. I know you predicted, we already talked about this and warned that the phenomenon of like intersectionality and woke ideology would inevitably lead to overt anti-Semitism. I guess my question is, Mr. Prophet, was there anything in you, and I think I know the answer, but that could have anticipated the violently anti-Semitic reaction immediately in response to 10/7? Like, I don't mean after. Yeah. I don't mean after the ID. Yeah, just really quickly.
If I'm being honest, like, maybe I'm not as prophetic as you're making me out to be, because I think that if you would have asked me if I played that scenario, what would happen? I would have said that a lot of the left-wing groups out there would say, of course what Hamas did was terrible, but they would give you a but. And there were people who said exactly that. Right. What I didn't expect was this sort of avalanche of hatred and the memes that came out with celebrated the Hamas massacre that were somehow legitimized by people, by various groups, groups that were empowered to teach our kids. The Coalition for Liberated Ethnic Studies that is dictating curriculum in a lot of school districts around the United States came out with memes of Hamas terrorists on hand gliders. So I didn't expect that. Was I surprised by the 31 student groups at Harvard that blamed Israel on October 9th before a single bomb was dropped in Gaza? I wasn't as surprised by that.
Wow.
This has become more significant in ways that I didn't expect. It's sort of expedited everything. I sort of predicted it, but I didn't predict it now or this early. And I didn't think October 7th would necessarily become the catalyst, because couldn't October 7th be the thing that reminds us of anti-Semitism? Recently, there was a group of Jewish women reproductive rights activists who broke out of the pro-choice organizations because they were feeling very uncomfortable. They were uncomfortable with the denial of rape against Israeli women. And they started this organization called the Red Tent that they could give support to various reproductive rights organizations.
Right.
61 groups in the reproductive rights community got together and wrote an open letter saying that you cannot be a Zionist and support reproductive rights. Now, that to me, like, if you read my book and I said, this is what could happen. But if you said to me that kind of thing would be commonplace or relatively commonplace now, 1 year after I, or 2 years after I wrote the book, to me, that is shocking. And I think we should be shocked by it. And it has gotten worse faster than I thought it would.
And it's ironic because Jews, and that includes Israel. Let me go back to my very opening that Israel and Jews are not the same thing. Okay. But Jews and Israel are both extraordinarily liberal societies. And so feminism, the only place you're going to find it in the Middle East, the only place, and it thrives, is in Israel. So that being said, because you seem to have this crystal ball, I'm going to ask you to gaze inside of it as a time capsule of things to come. Do you think the pendulum is going to swing back again to a place where Jews feel safe, where anti-Semitism will always exist, let's be honest, but where it's not overt, it's not accepted? And if so, how far into the future do you see that happening?
Yeah, it's a great question. And some of it really depends on what people like we all do to counter it, and the kind of movements we build and the kind of activism that we engage in. I think I would call what we're experiencing now a dual narrative. On the one hand, it's easier to push back against this radical ideology in public than it used to be. The people who are quick to call you a racist, they don't have the power that they used to in the public. So there are more and more people who are speaking out against it. There's more and more jokes being told. There's more and more videos being made and books being written. And I think, they're not going to win in the larger public realm, and they're losing in the public public realm. Where they are winning is in very particular institutions where they're strong and where they can create this monopoly of ideas. And you see that in K through 12 education, in higher education, in the arts, in certain medical associations and legal associations. And there we have a lot of work to do. The people who did this, they called it the long march through institutions, where they sort of slowly but surely took over institutions and installed this ideology within the bloodstream of these institutions. If we're going to reverse this, we have to do the hard work of a reverse long march through institutions, where we not only just fight anti-Semitism that we see or radicalism, but we try to get people to understand how to think critically. And we try to restore some semblance of sanity and normalcy in these institutions. And that's going to be a big lift. I mean, because they've really owned these institutions for so long, and people are reluctant to fight back. The average public school teacher, particularly in a very blue area, is not going to feel like they have a lot of support, even if silently many of their fellow teachers agree with them. So we have to work very hard to reverse that dynamic. It's going to take a long time. I think it's doable, but I don't think it's going to happen overnight, and we've got to be in for the long slog.
Yeah, I think that the common thought is that it takes two generations to re-educate a society, but first there has to be a society that wants to be or is willing to re-educate. So it will be interesting to see how this all evolves in the long run. So David, I always like to finish on a high note, and I know that you are ultimately at core an optimist. Where do you see Hatikva, the hope, in all of this?
Well, I think Israel is a remarkably resilient society, and a society that that knows how to fight for itself and stand up for itself. And while, you know, it's gone through some tough times, and there's some tough times ahead without a doubt, I have incredible faith. A lot of the social ills that we're talking about that are plaguing American society in the West are not plaguing Israel in the same way. Young people are not becoming as depressed. I mean, there are a lot are traumatized, I'm sure, by this current environment. They're more optimistic. They're more likely to stand up for their own values. And I think that Israel has a wellspring of strength that will allow it to navigate these troubled waters and come out a stronger country in the end. That's my hope.
I agree. And in the grand scheme of things, there, whatever oppression we have been the victims of, the Jews in Israel are most greatly characterized by our ability to rise high from the ashes. And I do believe we always will. David, is there anything else you'd like to add before we conclude?
Well, I think it's been a very rich conversation, and I really thank you for having me on.
It was such an honor and a privilege, and I really enjoyed this conversation as well. Again, for anybody who's still watching 10 hours later, the book is Woke Anti-Semitism. I put a link in the show notes, as well as all the links where you can find David and hear and see everything that he's doing to honestly change the world. Thank you, David.
Thanks a million.